Actually, a collection of various results, and mainly the theme of having these symmetries, or the question whether we do have to have some symmetries of these thick PUVMs or additional ones. That is what I think is the common theme of all these thoughts, and we will see some conclusion of that, but it's all ongoing work. And even from last night, I had some new results adding to the collection of results. And so I hope, although I would have liked to include some of the results from this morning, but of course there was no time. So during the week, I might do a little bit of an update of the results, and that can be in the discussion sections. One of the questions is also how we can use symmetries to construct something and use these symmetries hopefully to get towards a proof. And so I want to remind you of a more or less even more general problem. We want to have some normalized vectors where we have just a collection of m of these, and we want to have the overlap being a constant. And the special case is what we have the seeks, where we have d squared of vectors or states or however you would call them. And there we know what the constant is. We can also compute the constant for the other cases, but it doesn't really matter. That is part of what Zauner did in his thesis. And it's, to me, it was very appealing problems, and it's just an easy set of equations. And I do have some experience in solving analytically or algebraically some equations. So let's try what you get out of trying to solve these equations. And it's, we also then, well, a lot of other people found relations of these problems of just these equiangular lines or constant inner product lines. And we have this connection to spherical two designs, not the unitary design, which we will hear later about this week, that instead of integrating over the sphere, we can just do a finite summation for these vectors. And there's also this connection, I think it was, I learned it from Andreas Klappnagel's paper, to the Banach spaces, that they have a similar question where I have some bound in terms of something called a projection constant. And this bound is achieved if and only if we have these equiangular lines. But unfortunately, in the papers related to the theory of Banach spaces, no solutions were found. So, of course, when you see some links to other divisions of mathematics, you hope that the problem had been solved already there, but it hadn't. And but I still do not know if the people are interested in having the solutions, those people doing the work with theory of Banach spaces. I just wanted to put this up again and show you that there are connections to more divisions of mathematics just than quantum information, but none of them, at least to my knowledge, has a solution to the problem.
And ask him if any much was known about the existence. This was before Robin and Steve and so forth were doing things. And he told me that maximal sets of equiangular lines were known to exist in dimension 2, 3, and 8. And then, this was very nice, he said, there are likely no other cases where they exist. And then I told him about the recent work, but at the time it was a surprise to him.
And
after that paper.
So did he comment on the question or how important that question for their field is, or if they would be interested in?
He appeared interested. I can find the note. But then I never heard from him again.
But there anyone else in his field that's
interested? Yeah.
Since always the question, if you have a nice problem and you see it's nicely to be formulated, you have to have enough motivation or interest in getting a solution to that problem. Otherwise, it's just the few people of us who are interested in seeing this problem solved, and we would be happy either way. But the question is, it really has an impact. And I'm the wrong person to ask this question. I'm just fascinated by this nice problem and how difficult it turned out to be even to look at the small cases. So what is the most general approach in order to phrase it in terms of polynomial equations? The problem arises that we have to double the number of variables. So we have this real version. So we split into the real and imaginary part for each of the vectors. We get 2D variables in total. And of course, we want to have D squared vectors. So we get in total D cubed or of the order D cubed variables. And if you write this down, having the real and imaginary part of each of the vector, we can formulate the Hermitian inner product between the vectors. And what we get is just a system of polynomial equations. And then some people would say, OK, we have this nice theory of Graupner bases, which allows us to solve. Unfortunately, that is a theoretical method and not very practical in most of the cases. So already, if we go for dimension 3, and have only at least 5 vectors, so we're not even going for the 9 of them, at least I was not able to find a solution of the system, since just it explodes in memory and time. What we can do is a little bit of a simplification. Of course, what if we have this most general approach, we can pick the first vector to be just one of our standard basis vectors. So we get rid of all the variables in this just by setting this 1, 0. Then we have a phase degree of freedom, which tells us that we can make all the first entries being real entries and positive. So we have the solutions for all the first coordinates, which gives us D variables, which we get rid of. And then in general, we can also make the next entry here to be real and positive by multiplying this coordinate by a phase. We can get this upper triangle being 0, but it's just kind of a linear, or here it's a quadratic reduction of variables. We still have this cubic number of variables, and trying to solve the system, it's really complicated. If you do it for dimension 2, what we find is a little bit surprisingly with this normalization, we have essentially the unique solution in dimension 2. In dimension 3, we know we already have this infinite number of solutions. And to my knowledge, that's the only dimension where we know that we have an infinite number of solutions. For the other ones, of course, this trivial things that we can make a global chain of bases, but yeah, even with fixing the bases, we have an infinite family. So we can also ask what type of symmetries do we have or which can we impose to reduce the number of variables. And so I'm assuming that I have the sig theorems. I'm using the capital P instead of the capital pi for good reason, since I want to have now a unitary matrix acting on our POVM elements. And I want that the unitary matrix just permutes them. So it stabilizes the sets, but it does a permutation. So what we get is we get from all our possible automorphisms, so all the unitaries for which making a global chain of bases, we get a number element of our POVM. We, of course, get for every unitary, we get a mapping to a permutation corresponding to this unitary. And it can be shown, in particular, if we have sig POVMs, where all these elements are linearly independent, then the kernel of this mapping consists just of the global phase vectors. So what we get is, if we reverse this process, if we ask, giving a permutation on our indices, which can be realized by a unitary, of course, not necessarily all of the permutations can be realized by a unitary, but if one of them can be realized, then we get up to phases, a unique unitary matrix, and multiplying the permutations gives us a multiplication of the unitaries up to phases. And this is what is known as a projective representation of the permutation. What is unclear to me, and at least a little bit the approach of Marcus this morning about looking at the Gram matrix and possibly at these triple products, is the question, how can we really compute this automorphism group? So I'm giving just a set of states or projection operators, and I'm wondering which of the permutations can I realize by unity transformation. I don't know if anybody of you has an idea. I would be very happy. Of course, I could try, is there a unitary mapping corresponding to a certain permutation? But for this, I would have to search over all the permutations. A straightforward idea of simplifying this problem is, if I look in terms of the states, of course, if I have a basis of the states and another basis of the states, I can ask, is there a mapping of them, and does this extend to something that stabilizes my set?
Global phases. Is that the kernel of time?
The kernel of this representation, which I have not labeled. If you correspond this with pi, then it's the kernel of pi.
So it's a representation of A of S? Or you're thinking, it's, when you say projected representation of B permutation group, you mean it's S D squared or of A of S?
Of A of S. Since, of course, this contains all the scalar matrices, it's just the global phases. And in general, the kernel could be larger, but if the elements are linear independent, then one can show that the kernel is all the matrices in there. And as I just said, the problem is, if you want to just look for these automorphisms in terms of bases, we have, in general, we could choose D out of all D squared vectors, check whether they are linear independent or not, and try to map them onto another set of them. That's not really efficient. That is what I would like to look at. The problem is a bit more simple if you look for mutually unbiased bases. Since there we have a total collection of d squared plus d vectors, but they naturally come in bases. So there we only can map one of the bases to another of the bases. So there are far less candidates for all mappings, while here, and that I don't know. And another kind of characteristics is forbidden, since we are in the symmetric information complete case. If I would look just at pairs of our states and their inner products, if I had any generic set of vectors, of course, I would know that I have to preserve the inner products between them. So I could exclude some mappings. But here, because of the symmetries, I don't know of any good characteristics that allows me to have an efficient way of computing this. But nonetheless, we can look what do we find as kind of subgroups, or we can try to impose something of that. The next point is, when we look at these symmetries, we can have some special ones. And one question is, if I do have a particular symmetry, I get some permutation, and some of the elements of my POA might be stabilized. And Zauner in his thesis has this nice little theory that the number of fixed points equals the modulus square of the trace. He has phrased it in a little bit more general context, but for the sick QVMs, this context is fulfilled, and I don't go into the details, but we can just read off by essentially the trace of our unitary, how many of them are stabilized. And when we want to impose symmetries, like we do with the Weyl-Heisenberg group, then we want to have that our symmetry group acts transitively on them. That is, we can have one fiducial initial object, And we want to have that for every other element, we do find a unitary such that it is just mapped under our automorphism group automatically to this one. So we want to have a single orbit under all group. And then we can even have more, that we want to have only a symmetry group or a subgroup of the overall symmetry group, such that we have a unique element. Of course, it can only be unique up to a phase, but essentially what we want to have is we want to have a group of permutations with these layered elements, such that this is unique, and this implies that we don't have fixed points. Now, of course, the identity is always contained in our group, but all the others should not have a fixed point. That is what the regular action or symmetry group on the indices implies. And by this, we get that we have traceless matrices in our group. And this gives us candidates for regular symmetry groups, which by definition are as well transitively acting on them. And these are these nice unitary orbits. And those have been studied in other contexts by Martin and Andreas. So we can look at those and ask, can we find sig 2VMs which are covariant with respect to them? And this more or less yields us automatically to the Weyl-Heisenberg group. And why is this the case? If we have prime dimension, the only nice unitary error basis is given by the Weyl-Heisenberg group. If we have composite dimension, there are more possibilities, but that is kind of the generic one that exists in all dimensions. And if we are aiming at proving for all dimensions and imposing some symmetry, this is more or less the only candidate. So I don't have to tell much about it for you. We have this group generated by X and C, where we have X just a shift operator, kind of in the original space, and the shift in the Fourier transform space. We have these relations, and then if we just mod out the center, I have now the displacement operator x to the a, c to the b, without this additional phase, which in my context does not really make a big difference, but it, in some sense it might make a difference when one does really look at equations for the vectors and not for the projectors. Then we get different phases in the equations, and if you want to solve for the equations, it's really these phases that makes the problem even more complicated. So if we can get rid of this phase degree of freedom, it does help us a little bit. So what has also been very nicely presented in Marco's paper is when we are now looking for symmetries of our covariant POVMs, then we can actually look at what is the automorphism group of our stabilizer or the group that acts transitively with respect to that our POVM is covariant. It is not necessarily the only symmetries we can have additionally, but it's again a good candidate, and that is something at least we can compute. For arbitrary groups, you can look at the question, what are the matrices that by conjugation map the group onto itself? And so these, what is in other contexts known as the Jacobi group, or in quantum information, maybe better known as the Clifford group, is we have this action model with the phases that when we conjugate an element x to the a, c to the b, what we get is an x to the a prime, b prime, and we can get up to the phases, everything just by a linear transformation on the integers modulo d. So we get a homomorphism from all the matrices acting by conjugation, into the special linear group. And as generators of the group, what we have is the discrete Fourier transform, which essentially corresponds to interchanging A and B. But of course, interchanging the coordinates does not have determinant one. So we add a minus sign to one of them. And we have a diagonal matrix which has some quadratic phases, and it depends whether we have an odd or even dimension, how this is defined in the very detail. But we can look at these generators, look at this group and its structure, and that is what you can find in Marco's paper, where he has also added the operation by complex conjugation. Since the group itself is closed under complex conjugation, it just gives us the transposed inverse, and we can add this to the calculus just to have one additional object in our set of candidates for automorphisms. And what Zauner then has, looking at the solutions for small dimensions, so in his thesis, you find solutions, I think, up to dimension 5 analytically, and or maybe 4, I have a copy here, I would have to check again. And then also some numeric solutions for higher dimensions, and analyzing the solutions, what he has conjectured is the following, that for every dimension, we have a SIGQVM, which are the orbit of one fiducial vector under the Weyl-Heisenberg group. And what is more, this fiducial vector can be found as an eigen operator in that sense, or just from an eigen vector of an element of this Jacobi group, which has order 3. So based on the observation for the small dimensions, there he had figured out he can build a SIGQVM with respect to Weyl-Heisenberg. He found that all of these have this symmetry, and then he came up with this conjecture that we can construct it in this way, and then maybe partially by translation errors, Marcus made some variation of this conjecture and studied further the properties of this element of order T, and Steve did also some job on that, that if we have a dimension which is not a multiple of 3, then we essentially have only one element of order 3. But if the dimension is a multiple of 3 or 9, we can have more than the single element. And the question is whether we necessarily have this symmetry. And when I studied, I will come to this a bit more, but when I studied the solutions, I accidentally found in dimension 12 a counterexample. So I found a solution which is a SIGQVM with respect to the Weyl-Heisenberg group. It was also an eigenvector of an element of order 3, but it turned out that it was one out of a different conjugacy class. So this was one of the strongest versions of the conjecture that Marcus made, is that if we have this order 3 symmetry, it should always be conjugated to the 1. But in the example which I more or less accidentally found, it was not the case. So this brought me to the question which was unsolved when I met Marcus in July, whether we do have support for this conjecture for dimension 12. So in dimension 12, we did have a solution with the Weyl-Heisenberg group, and we had an additional symmetry of order 3, but it was not this very specific element. It was not conjugated to it. And it turned out that we actually can find a solution, and so this is a paper which is not yet on the archive. It has in total 16 pages, and just to show you, so this is the middle. So this is page 8, and then we start, and this is just the first coordinate of the fiducial vector. And since the referees had asked me to put all of it, so it goes on. So there are 8 pages just displaying the coordinates of this fiducial vector. I'm still not really convinced that it is useful to have this, but anybody who wants to have it, you can get it. The problem is, that is what all my remark this morning was related to. There might be a way of changing the basis or the representation that everything simplifies. I don't know how to find this chain of basis. Here, part of the simplification, since the original equations defining this, they have a couple of 100 digits. Just the equations defining it, and the solutions and of course as well, and then looking at the structure of the field and having a tower of fields helped to simplify it, but I'm not happy about this. And that was, that is what I have learned by email conversation, but I have not yet seen, and I, of course the solutions should be related, but so I hope that it does not turn out to be that complicated, but that was also part of my initial motivation, though that is more or less the state of the art as far as I know that. We had these algebraic solutions, and here I have it at up to dimension 5, Zauner gave solutions. And then we have this solution in dimension 7 and 19, which are kind of singular, or most likely singular solutions. Then we have this numerical evidence, which I still list only up to 45, so my apologies for 46 and 47. And then some other dimensions have been added. I hope I didn't not. Yeah. So 14 is still missing, and it's still kind of puzzling to me, but the original hope, or maybe too wishful thinking, was, okay, let's compute the solutions for 2, 3, 4, 5, have a closer look at this, and we see a pattern, and then we only prove that this is a solution for all dimensions. Since the solutions of all the other spaces get that complicated, and the fields we get look to be very complicated, I have no clue how to come up with a general formula for it. And that I still have some hope that it exists, but it is discouraging. It's the equations are complicated, the solution, the fields are very complicated, a clever change of basis might just put everything down to something simple, and these representations we heard this morning might be something in that direction, and that is, of course, something I would like to, or I'm going to look at is, what does the Gram matrix and this triple product matrices look like in these cases? Maybe they are simple, maybe they are not. That's just something I have not yet computed. So the kind of new idea in terms of the Weyl-Heisenberg group is that we just only look for one fiducial vector. We define all these others in terms of these displacement operators. We enforce the conditions about the inner products. And what we got is we now have only one initial vector, so we have 2D variables. And what we can do is we can set the first of the coordinates being real one. So we have only 2D minus 1. And it turns out if you really take this approach in terms of computing a Gödel base and trying to solve it, already the case D equals 6 is getting quite complicated. So I was not able to solve it with this approach. Actually, what is possible, or has been possible for me to solve this, to rephrase everything in terms of projection operators. So I replace this initial vector, which is given in terms of 2D variables, by just a generic object with d squared now unconstrained values. I'm adding the inner product equations are just now quadratic equations, while these have been of degree 4. And of course, I have also to put the constraint that I have a trace 1 projection operator. So I get even more equations and essentially have squared the number of variables, but this allows me to compute all the solutions for dimension 6, or up to dimension 6, which are group covariant with respect to the Weyl-Heisenberg. And what it turns out is that for dimension up to 6, all the solutions we find is, with the exception of dimension 3, we only have a finite number of solutions. And all these solutions obey this additional order 3 symmetry. So even without imposing them, kind of confirming the known results, is we find that we have to have this, or that it turns out we have this additional order 3 symmetry.
But isn't that really, well, that's only a non-trivial statement in dimensions 3 and 6, right? It's 2, 4, and 5.
No, we still could have something that does not have this order 3 symmetry.
That's right, yeah, that has no symmetry.
That is only covariant with respect to Weyl-Heisenberg, but it's, of course, when you give these numerics, you did a more or less exotic randomized search, whatever that would be, but having it run for a long time, you didn't find anything else, and all the solutions turn out to be related under the Clifford group. And just by these relations, the Clifford group automatically acts on them, and just by the number of solutions you get, you can confirm that you have an order 3.
Right.
And then your statement is true that only in these dimensions, since we have this additional order 3 symmetry, it must be the one conjecture by Zauner in the construction. But still, there is a small chance that the numerics would miss one of the solutions. Of course, it's in this small dimensional space, it's unlikely. But at least that is what I could confirm up to dimension 6 so far, maybe 7 is again doable, but we always had this symmetry. So, since this, at least at the time I did this transformation for the first time, or even with that approach using the vectors, I still can do it essentially only up to dimension 5. If I want to go beyond, I really start to impose the symmetry in order to find solutions. So what I'm doing is I'm looking at some additional symmetry. So I pick one of the elements that act non-trivially on the Weyl-Heisenberg group, and I want to find a lower dimensional eigenspace. And now my Ansatz is to use just a generic linear combination in that eigenspace. So what I can do is I can reduce the number of variables, and since the computations are, it's not a strict bound, but more or less the complexity grows double exponential. So reducing the number of variables is really a good thing in general too. It is a bit in contrast to what I just said about replacing the vector by a general projection operator, since those systems are a bit more easy to solve than the original one. So you have to try essentially every approach that comes to your mind and hope that one of them works. But as I said, it's, you have a little bit better chances to find the solutions. And what I in general did, and that is how I found this particular solution in dimension 12, is I just iterate over all possible symmetries, starting with large order of them, since large order implies lower dimensional spaces, and try to solve for the system. And by chance, I just picked an element of a different conjugacy class of order 3, and for that I was able to solve it, and only the most recent computation, which were more complicated using that element of Zauno, it was kind of an indication why I most likely had stopped the computation with the Zauno element, but since it succeeded with that other element, it was just nice. So this is a general approach. Impose additional symmetry to reduce the dimensionality of your space, and of course it also pays off if you go for numerics, just to reduce the number of variables. And in terms of this particular element of Zaunos, one finds that the dimension of the three eigenspaces are more or less of equal dimension. They differ at most by two. Zauno has also a formula and analysis of the dimension of them. But essentially, we get a reduction by a factor of three using the Zauno element. The distribution of the eigenvalues might be different for the other conjugacy class, or is different for the other conjugacy classes. So what I used for is a computer algebra system called Magma, which is a more special purpose program than Maple or Mathematica. But the nice thing is it supports group theory and Grodner bases, computations mod D, so all the objects I need are in there. So that is what made it attractive to me. So what I'm doing is I'm looking at essentially the special linear group mod D. It is sufficient to look at the conjugacy classes of the elements, since if I find one solution, all the other solutions would be conjugated within this Jacobi or Clifford group. I get this system of polynomial equations. I can try to solve them. So for this step, I have to transform my initial equations essentially in kind of a triangular form. So I want to have a polynomial in only one of the variables, then I want to have some polynomials in two of them, and then I can recursively solve for these equations. The problem is, when trying to solve these, what I get is I have to construct an extension field of the rationals. So my polynomial in general would not have any root over the rationals, so I have to construct a number field, and with every step inserting the solutions, I get a more and more complicated field. And then there's another technicality. We are only interested in real solutions. Or in terms of the projection operators, we really want to have Hermitian operators with trace one. So not all the solutions we get from our system of equations necessarily correspond to solutions of our original problem. The nice thing here is kind of we are lucky that we only have a finite number of solutions in the complex space. So with every system of polynomial equations, we do have the set of solutions, and the set of solutions is always defined over the algebraic closure, so over the complex numbers. And we could run into the problem that we had an infinite number of solutions in complex space, and then we would have to figure out what solutions do we have in real space. And checking whether there is one or not is, again, a hard problem related to real algebraic geometry. But in all situations, apart from dimension three, I've only got a finite number of solutions. So that was the nice thing with that. And then one can also look at what are the automorphisms of this number field and find what is a real subfield and then compute only the solutions there. And then when I say compute the automorphism of the solutions, I'm computing with respect to the Clifford group or the Jacobi group. So I have only a finite number of candidates. And then so it's in general only a subset of the automorphisms. I might miss some which are not being contained in the Jacobi group.
Poly six, so they're always generated from the fiducial vector by Weil-Heisenberg?
This is the context of the Weil-Heisenberg group, since these polynomial equations are just related to essentially what I had here, that I let operate the group on them.
Okay. So in that case, then the automorphisms are always in the Clifford group.
Not necessarily.
No, they are. I mean, it's pretty easy to prove, actually. Basically, it just comes from the fact that the projectors on the vectors form a basis, like d by d matrices. I mean, you have a counterexample?
I don't have an argument that you get all of them. That's the only point.
So there are perfect regolements that are not automorphisms, of course, but any automorphism is a perfect regolment. Unitary automorphisms.
It's reasonable, but
yeah.
Frankly, I haven't thought about this.
Okay.
So, what was one of my initial things to look at was dimension 6. Also, because of this weak relations we have between mutually unbiased spaces through some classical combinatorial object, going to the dual of this classical object, and then back to the from the mutually unbiased to the 6. But for this relation to hold, all the objects must exist. And in dimension 6, we know the classical objects do not exist. So that was, for me, a motivation to look at dimension 6, of course, since there we don't know what the status of the mutually unbiased spaces is. And back then, we had only numerical solutions for it. And that was not too hard to find some solution. And it turns out that, as I said before, so now we have a three-dimensional space in which we find our solution. So we have only 5 variables. We can compute all the solutions. We get 144 in complex space, but what we in general get 96 solutions of group covariant sig PVMs, but actually they are either related by complex conjugation or by a global change, which is just a change by the Clifford group. And that number agrees again with what can be found in the numerical table. And it also then later agrees with, if we do not impose the symmetry and compute the solutions, we don't get more. So for this, it's the only solutions we have. So the example in dimension 12, I showed you a little bit of the Zauner symmetry, but even that more simple solution, the field where we define our solution, what we have, if we have the square root of 2, the square root of 13, then square roots relating to the square root of 13 again, we of course have to have the square root of minus 1, and what we have is this third root of unity. I could have written those two together as 12th root of unity. And then what we get is a fiducial vector, which has this more or less nice form. It's not normalized, so the first coordinate here is 16. But that helps me a little bit to save on the other ones. And now these solutions at least fit onto two transparencies. So that's maybe, depending on our handwriting, the same what Marcus gets for the Zauner solution. In my case, at least, I was not able to simplify the expression for the Zauner solution. But I have no clue how to generalize this. So it doesn't really provide much of an insight. So another thing was, okay, for prime dimension, we only have the Weyl-Heisenberg. Why not look for other symmetries? So if we have some other symmetries, maybe only for power of 2 dimensions, probably we can do something. And the dimension 8 solution we had before, that is what is known as these Hogar lines, they are related just to the 3-qubit Pauli. And so one is tempted to say, okay, let's just always look for the Pauli group on n qubits and find solutions. And then in paper by Chris Gottsill and Erwin Roy, it was shown you can only have for 1 qubit and for 3 qubits solutions, but not for any other number of qubits. So that's discouraging. We would have a family of groups for which we would like to construct discovered CPUEMs, but I tried it kind of with my approach and failed in getting them, and they had a more direct look at the equation and found that you cannot solve it in other cases than one or three qubits. But what we can have is we can have, as I had in the beginning, we can have these unitary error bases, these abstract error groups, which just have these properties that we have a group of all d squared. We have a reducible projective representation in dimension d, and we can try to solve for something that is coherent with respect to them. We can play the same game as we did with the Clifford group. We can look at the automorphism group of our group and impose some further symmetries, and now essentially use the very same program as before. So we take a fiducial vector, we take our POEM being the orbit under our group, and we can try to solve for these equations. And okay, that's what I did. I will have this again a little bit later. I confirmed again the numerics in dimension 6. So in dimension 6, we can have, instead of the Weyl-Heisenberg group, some other non-abelian group for the index group. And there was a numerical solution being reported in the paper by Wins et al. And not surprisingly, I confirmed that it's really the solution algebraically. And the next interesting dimension is, of course, dimension 8. And that is what is currently ongoing. There are some 50 different error groups. And by now, I think for something like 15 of them, I do have solutions. For maybe 5 of them, there doesn't exist a solution. But the interplay between the solutions is completely open. Maybe they are just essentially the same. Maybe they aren't. So this is just a machinery we can look at. But I want to do a little bit comments also on how we find these solutions. So the main technique is to use this technique of Grebner bases, which allows us to transform our initial system of problem equation in something in this triangular form. The problem is when we do the direct implementation where we have all our phases, the roots of unities which arise from the groups in it, it's very expensive, but we can actually do the computation just over the rational numbers. And there is a kind of very efficient way of computing it called the F4 algorithm by the French guy Fauchère, which is implemented in Magma. It uses a lot of memory, but it does the job. But even for my problems, it didn't. And what one can do is, that's an idea by Liz Arnold in her thesis, one can compute Grebner bases modulo a lot of primes and then try to reconstruct it. And that is actually how I found this dimension 12 solution. And what I have reported here is in dimension 10, I have to compute 65 of these modular Grebner bases. Here I have only 500 digits, while in dimension 12, the final system in triangular form had even, I think, something like 10,000 digits in the coefficients, so nothing to see. And the solutions are, again, in something large degree number field. So all very discouraging, but at least we have some objects that we could do further analysis with them. This is, again, some summary of what we have. So it's more or less the solutions we had. And it turned out that in dimension 8, we even have a larger symmetry, but all of them have at least this order 3 symmetry. This is what we get just by the action of the Jacobi group on them. And if I write 48 plus 48, this means just by complex conjugation. So what is this extended Clifford group? They are just coupled. And if I, in that case, for instance, the solutions are stable under complex conjugation. So we have an additional order 2 symmetry of our solutions. So there is a convention for labeling groups, and the group number 11 of order 36 gives rise to this dimension 6 PVM. There we get some 48, somehow related to these initial ones. It's not yet clear if there is a relationship among them. And as I said, this is just one of them in dimension 8, which I have listed here, where we don't have an additional symmetry, which so far did not occur for the Weyl-Heisenberg group, that he had no additional symmetry. But again, this might be an obstacle about that. So another idea then is, of course, if we have a collection of sig PVMs and we let the automorphism group of our group with respect to what we are covariant operator in it, we get even more of them. So in dimension 4, we get 16 Weyl-Heisenberg sig PVMs, of course, each of which has 16 elements. And they are all disjoint, so what we get is, we get 256 vectors in our four-dimensional space. And now we can look at what are the mutual inner products between them. And actually, these are the absolute value of the mutual inner products, and I'm computing in terms of the operators. And I found that there are 23 different values. Some of them are nice, and some of them are more complicated. I have not even looked at them more closely. But what we can do is, we can just use these 256 vectors and put an edge, so we define a graph of them, and we put an edge if the inner product between that squared is 1 over 5. So in some sense, we link two of them if they are having the right inner product. And then analyzing this graph, we find that we have not only these 16 sig PVMs, we actually get 32 of them. So we can regroup our vectors, and we get some new sig PVMs out of them. And then having a closer look at them, it turns out that the new ones, we always pick four vectors of certain ones and recombine them into a new one. And then doing the analysis of the symmetry group, what we then find is we have again the very same symmetry which we had before. And this new symmetry group or these new sig PVMs are actually just related by a global chain of bases, which I was able to compute in that situation. And it turned out that this chain of bases is not an element of the Clifford group. So this might be a counterexample to what you just said before.
One set of sig vectors into a different set.
Yes.
So one set map, a set into itself, that permutes the elements of the set, which is what you were describing earlier as an automorphism, right?
But it's, say, what it does, it stabilizes the whole set of the 256 vectors.
Okay, but that's, that's different from what I was saying.
Yeah, it's not completely, but it's a little bit related. Since that global chain of phases is not within the original symmetry group we would like to look at. And that is again this question where I said, I don't know how to compute the automorphism group. It's the same question. In general, I don't know how to relate two sig PVMs. And looking at the Gwarm matrix is kind of promising, or at least three-dimensional eigenspace of it. But there we have the problem that we have to pick the phases for all of the sig PVMs correctly. And looking at this triple product might help, but I'm not quite sure if this already is conclusive to tell whether Prusik periods are related or not. So I think that is one of the questions you should really spend some time of it, asking how to decide whether Prusik periods are related or not. And do we find some that are not? So what I had already mentioned is that up to dimension 6, starting with the Weil-Heisenthal group, we have this additional order 3 symmetry. In dimension 12, we have these two different types of symmetry or additional symmetries. I still have not completely tried to relate those. Maybe we even, that is something I found in dimension 8, even if we have some different types of groups, it can happen that, so we have many different abstract power groups, but sometimes even the very same set of sig QVMs is both covariant with respect to one group and with respect to another group, which is just that it is the orbit of a much bigger group, and within that much bigger group, we have subgroups of order B squared, which can be used to define our sig QVMs.
Well, what does many mean exactly?
Many means, as I said, I think I have, so in total it's something like 50 different groups of order 64 that do support the projective representation. And out of these something like 50, I have constructed solutions for something like 15, and for something like 5 of them, the system of polynomial equation does not have a solution. So for instance,
10 does have a solution.
No, 15 have a solution, 5 don't, and for the remaining 30, I don't know yet.
I see, right. Okay.
It's just that I'm processing them at the moment, there's other relations among them. As I said, sometimes they are even the very same set of CQVMs, or sometimes they are, like in dimension 4, regrouping them. So the set of vectors in total is the same, but they are differently structured. So there's a lot of things to be explored. And this is what I have here. The most rich structure are those that arise from the Hogarth. Since there we have the group we are starting with is the Pauli group on 3 qubits, and we have this huge Clifford group on 3 qubits acting as an automorphism on it. And it turned out that we do have some additional symmetries on the Hogarth lines, so we can use kind of quite a bigger group, and all the subgroups of that group, which are abstract error bases, give rise to CQVMs. They are all the same. So we have different groups, but the same CQVMs. So it's a little bit puzzling. As I said, I'm still, what I'm writing here, I don't know what the relations between them are, if they are all equivalent or not, or if they come in different classes. These are the new candidates, but essentially by the construction, that is the conclusion, or what I would really like to see is, well, we always have to have some symmetry. It is imposing no symmetry at all. I was not able to do. This regrouping of the CQVMs might help to find something. At least we have some candidates. So in terms of the more general problem of Lemmens and Seidel, that where we allow for more inner products, we get a larger collection of sets of states, and maybe we find something which does not have a symmetry. As I said, so far I was not. So the conclusion is the symmetries, most of them just come out of the construction, since we have to impose the symmetries in order to find solutions. And whether there are any CQMs without any additional symmetry, other than the symmetry imposed by the inner products, I don't know. Thanks.
question. Sorry, not for now. Today. So you said it was easy to see that every automorphism is in fact different. So how do you do that? Is that very easy to sketch, or could you sketch it?
Yeah, probably. Maybe I could go for it.
Yeah.
So sorry, it's been a while since I did this, so I hope this is the right proof, but I think it's right. let's see. So we have some unitary U that maps six vectors into six vectors. So say it maps your fiducial vector into psi I, and I guess psi I is for psi j is going to be pj psi 0 for general. Okay? So then that follows, of course, that PIU will fix psi 0. Okay, so let's call this U bar. And I want to show that U bar is a perfect U bar.
Yeah, it does in here,
isn't it? Yeah, these are. Yeah. Then, yeah, okay, I guess we're working higher dimensions, so we really should. Yes, take the diagram. I want to show that U bar is a perfect development. So it's kind of an obvious perfect development that I want it to be, right? Because U bar psi I is going to be psi, let's call it sigma of I in general. And so I want to claim that U bar is a perfect development that maps PI to P sigma of I.
So are you violating any generality by not including phase vectors here?
No.
Maybe not.
I don't think so. I mean, I could be wrong about that, so there could be some phases, but I don't think that's going to be an issue.
Okay.
Yeah, it might be. So let's say it's a perfect group up to phases. So I'm not sure about that, 100%. But like I said, it's been a while since I... okay, so now I'll point out that because these vectors form a basis for the d by d matrices, so that implies that there's the unique linear map which takes psi I to psi sigma I. And I guess psi 0 goes to 0. Right? Okay. And the map that takes PI to P sigma I is a linear map. Because again, and P0 is the identity, so it goes to the identity. Right? Because again, these are linearly independent. And so we know, therefore, that U is this map, and since U is unitary, it's a perfect product. Now let's see what happens if you put in phases. So if you put in phases, kind of those phases disappear once you get to this stage, and so
yes.
U is still mapping PI to P sigma I, and therefore it has to be preferred up to global phase, which is kind of preferred.
Yeah.
Okay.
Are there any other questions? Wait, David,
do we have time, or?
So, yeah, yes.
So I was wondering, it's been a long time. I've looked at your paper at the time it came out, or with it, I guess, using these nice error groups. And so I seem to remember that you had some nice error groups which were projective representations of abelian groups, is that right? It is true that all projective representations of abelian groups are more or less Weyl-Heisenberg groups and tensor powers of them. I think at the time I had the suspicion that might be true, but I can't remember whether I knew it at the time or whether.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's also been some time for me. I know that there are some non-abelian groups which also admit faithful projective representations.
Yes.
In the abelian case.
Never mind. I take back
what I was saying. But if it's abelian, then the group has to be of the form direct product of the group with itself, A times A. So here it's Zn times Zn.
Yeah, and also if it's abelian, then by the classification of all finite abelian groups, it's more or less, it's a direct product of cyclic groups, and then people can classify all projective representations from them. And I believe that in the end, the tensor products of Weyl-Heisenberg groups would be all nice error groups you could get with an abelian base group, but they can't get by a chemical mistake. So I thought if one classifies nice error groups, the ones with abelian base groups seem not to provide much more than we get by looking at Weyl-Heisenberg groups. Right?
Not really. The problem is that we cannot just take the tensor product of two solutions to get a solution in higher space.
If
you look at the cubic case, so we know that for n equals 1 and n equals 3, we do have solutions.
Yeah.
For the others, we don't. If you go to Q twits, something similar might happen. So we know we do have a solution for n equal 1. I computed for n equal 2, there is no solution.
Yes, I computed that 2 and for q. Two five-dimensional ones, I think I also tried to look for them, and I didn't find them, which could be my lack of numerical skill. No, this is not the point I wanted. Of course, you get different Heisenberg-Weyl groups if you factor your dimension in different ways, right? But I think this is all the ones you get. If you look at nice error groups with abelian base groups, it's just one stuff.
But we always have only a few of them. Okay. Of course, for the two groups, there are always many. So we have these 50 in dimension 8, but it's not clear whether any of the groups is better than the other ones in some respect. It's the nice ones, I would say, are those which have a generalization to higher dimension. And the most natural ones are, of course, the abelian ones, where we just have more and more copies of the group or just the tensor products. So this could give us solution in infinite family of dimensions, but the example of the qubit is a little bit discouraging.
We want to take a different approach and look at powers of three, so find the smallest besides one, the smallest power, and powers of five, and the smallest power that exists. That sequence could be very simple, superior.
There is, at least, we want to have some kind of generalization. That although that element of Zaunus, this order 3 element, it is actually an order 3 element with respect to all volume. It's actually already order 3 over the integers, this matrix. And that is what makes it kind of appealing, since it's something that exists in all dimensions. But as I also said before, if you just have not all the dimensions, but an infinite family, would already be nice, at least for me.
Yes.
Okay, so let's thank Marcus again. We have a coffee break now.